is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One from Eagle Speak. As a quick reminder to those that are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll find the chat room. That's a great place to go ahead and, while the show's going forward, if you have some observations about the show or if there is a question you would like for us to direct to our guest, if it doesn't look like we're headed in that direction, please jump into the chat room, throw it up our direction. Both Eagle One and I will be there during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to grab your great ideas and bring it into the conversation. And if you're new to Midrats, or if you've got to jump off halfway through the show and you want to see what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. And one thing we have validated recently, if you are an iTunes kind of person, for those that don't know, we've had an ongoing battle with Apple, but we've got a compromised position right now. If you're at the show page, you'll see a little button there that is the iTunes button. If you go ahead and press that, that'll let your iTunes go ahead and grab the archive, which will make it a little less clunky for you if you want to catch some of your shows after time is done. Now let's get on with the show. This is August of 2014. 100 years ago, we're all starting to, well, not all of us, but those that are so minded are looking back at the First World War, which, as I kind of put in the introduction to the show online, it really did set the scene for what we consider the modern era, brought to an end, at least for the Anglosphere time kind of view of the world, the Edwardian era, and everything that followed and how we live today is really so closely related to those decisions that were made in 1914 through 1918 and the final signing of the Versailles Treaty after that. And we brought on what I think is going to be a great guest today to talk about that. We're going to use as kind of a touching off point an article that he wrote recently in the National Interest, titled World War I, Five Ways Germany Could Have Won the First Battle of Atlantic, part of their Five Ways series. You can find a link to that over at the show page if you'd like to read it. But we're going to broaden it a bit. We're going to talk about some of the conditions that led up to it and some of those things that today are still affecting how we look at the world and how we are forced to interact with the results of those decisions so long ago. Yeah, Jim Holmes has a PhD. He is also a professor of strategy at the Naval War College and a senior fellow at the University of Georgia School of Public International Affairs. He's not just a pretty face in academia. He also is a former U.S. Navy surface warfare officer. And after that, he has spent his time in the academic arena and has also received his PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's published books as well with his longtime co-author and guest here on Midrats, Toshi Yoshihara. They are Strategy in the Second Nuclear Age and also Red Star Over the Pacific. He's published over 25 chapter books and 150 scholarly essays, along with hundreds of opinions and columns, think tank analysis, and other works. He blogs over at the Naval Diplomat and is an occasional contributor to Foreign Policy, the National Interest, our buddies over at War on the Rocks, CNN, and, of course, U.S. Naval Institute's Proceedings. Also, if you've ever seen him as a moderator on a panel, he's quite good at that. We saw him last over in San Diego. But, hey, Jim, we got you on Midrats today. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks a lot. I have to admit I'm feeling a little bit blue. They towed away the USS Saratoga from Newport the other day, which I don't know about you, but I deployed with that ship. So it seems as though the Narragansett Bay has become a non-naval port except for schoolhouses now.
I saw that. Old Sarah was
sold her
a little
for a
long
penny.
In the two.
Yeah, she looked horrible. It was a long time coming.
Yeah, one of her sisters, the Connie, I actually have some time on. And what's funny is when I was on the Connie in 2001, she was in better shape than the Enterprise was in the late 90s, and I was on her. But, of course, the Enterprise just left the pier and is being cut apart as we speak.
Yeah, rumor has it that the John F. Kennedy will come to Newport as a museum ship. So we're all hoping for that. So it may work out okay.
Yeah, they've got some good wood there in the wardroom. I think the Kennedy, if they can get the needle gun on it enough and pretty her up, she would make a pretty good museum ship.
One hopes.
Well, hey, but before we get into the specifics of the article you wrote, I thought just as a scene setter is, you know, looking at the World War I, it's easy, and it's a good excuse, I think, you know, the August 2014 to look back 100 years. But many times it's frustrating to get people who are more focused on, you know, getting their wings or getting their qualifications or working through their PQS or focusing on their career to look back in history. And I know you see this at the War College. A lot of times people are only introduced to the lessons that were hard fought and hard learned until mid-career or later. And I think that one of the challenges of World War I is pretty well exemplified if you're in Washington, D.C. You have this huge monstrosity of a World War II memorial plopped right in the middle. But you have to look real hard to find that little tiny World War I memorial. And in many ways, it's kind of forgotten. But there are a lot of things about the First World War that the national security professional today should have in the back of his mind. What are some of those big, broad things about what happened 100 years ago that is really important for people today to have inside their brain bucket to make sure that it flavors any of the observations they're making about today?
Oh, wow. I think you just set the scene for an entire hour. I think I could take up an entire hour answering that. I guess, I don't know, let me start really broad, and maybe I'll just go through three things, and then we'll see where that takes us. You mentioned the cultural aspect is huge. You talked about essentially the end of an era and all that. I mean, just look at Downton Abbey, for example. Everybody watches that. Once you actually see that unfolding in the middle of that TV program on PBS. So yeah, there's certainly that sort of thing is going. I mean, I'm not sure it really dawned on me until the first time I traveled in the British Isles just how different it is. We think about World War II as being the war, whereas if you go around in Great Britain, you'll see all the big war memorials are all pretty much dedicated to the Great War. So there's a lot of that. I mean, there's a lot of great cultural artifacts that over in Europe that go with it, like the poems of Wilfred Owen and Rupert Brooke and all that great stuff, which strangely enough, I don't think you see so much from the Second World War or other wars that have come after. So, yeah, there's clearly a lot of grist there on the cultural side. Secondly, I think I think one of the other things, one of the big questions that we always raise with our students, and it's one that I get a lot of grist out of, is just the way this was a debate over whether economic interdependence puts an end to great power war. This is something that you hear in this current era of globalization. And keep in mind that in some respects, the world was as globalized or more globalized a century ago than it is now. But yet, we still saw countries essentially flout their economic interests in order to do what they thought they needed to do on the battlefield in Western Europe. There was a great debate between our guy, Alfred Thayer Mahan, president of the War College, and an English intellectual named Norman Angell. Angell published a book just before the war claiming that no nation in its right mind would go to war because it would be economically disastrous. Mahan went back, they went back and forth in the press and so forth, and Mahan said that simply isn't true. Angell obviously had the misfortune to publish that right before the war and ended up looking kind of bad. But nonetheless, it's a debate that still echoes today. And finally, just from a strictly naval standpoint, it's kind of interesting that just about now in 1914, the United States is not in the war, obviously, until 1917. But we are thinking, or at least certain officials in the United States are thinking about what to do with the United States as long as the war is going on and the United States stays on the sidelines. there was an interesting exchange of letters between former President Theodore Roosevelt, between Mahan, who lived only a few months into the First World War, and with the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Franklin Roosevelt, of course, the two Roosevelts being distant cousins. And they were just basically debating where to put the Navy. This was before the days of the two-ocean Navy. And they were saying, okay, well, we've got this one-ocean fleet. What should we do with it? And they ultimately ended up deciding that if the Navy needs to stay in one ocean, it ought to be the Pacific, just in case the Japanese snap up the German islands in the Pacific and so forth. So kind of there was some big thinking going on in naval circles as well at the outset of the conflict.
When we look at World War One, one of the most confusing aspects for me has always been it seemed like a war that should never have happened. Because the way people got into it didn't make any sense. Can you kind of go over, to the extent you can, so we can lead into your article, you know, how did they get in this mess of the Great War?
Yeah, well, I mean, when we think about these big conventional conflicts as being sort of straightforward, we're always differentiating between conventional and unconventional war. But yet, even there's even a lot of ambiguity even in these big conventional wars like the First World War, and historians still go the rounds on why exactly it happened. John Keegan, when he did his book on the First World War, probably in the late 1990s, I don't remember exactly which year, but he basically started off that book and he said, look, this was a needless conflict. If there had been goodwill in European capitals, it never should have happened. So, I mean, I guess this relates back to the cultural aspects as well. We know that Thucydides tells us that nations go to war for fear, honor, and interest, these being the three strongest motives that impel human actions. So you can have a lot of fun in sort of a macabre sense, applying Thucydides to figure out why they did what they did. To try to nail it down a little bit more analytically, though, I would probably call attention to Clausewitz, his famous dictum that the value of the political object is what determines the magnitude and the duration of the effort that you put into gaining that object. Basically, how many lives, how much treasure, how much military hardware, and so forth that you spend on a conflict, and for how long. I think that to the extent that European decision makers were thinking in analytical terms like that, I think they were severely lowballing the magnitude, how much it would cost, and also the duration of the conflict. So essentially, they thought that if it was going to be a cheap effort, they could get their way quickly and painlessly, then they could go to war for sort of so-so political aims. I'm not sure that probably doesn't answer anything, but maybe that'll at least chain on to some more productive discussion.
There's a picture out, a little comic, I think, that has a bunch of sailors fighting in a bar, and equates how World War One was fought in bar fight terms, which is, it's funny, but it's surprisingly accurate. But the war, you know, everybody can draw certain things. But one thing I've always found interesting is everybody focuses on battle in Flanders with the British and the French and the Germans and the Americans coming at the last minute, which is kind of natural because that's the environment we came in. But what happened in many ways was the match that lit the tinderbox was a long simmering, almost inevitable conflict between two empires that did not survive the war, the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Russian Empire. And some very interesting things happened in the beginning involving Pan-Slavism, which, you know, I've been looking around trying to find some modern version. I think in many ways when you look at what's going on in the Slavic countries, that Pan-Slavism is pretty much gone, and I guess it's been replaced in some ways by that Russian nationalism. But huge war battles were fought between the Austro-Hungarians and the Russians before the Russians collapsed. At the time, the Germans just destroyed the Russian armies in the Battle of Tannenberg to the north. To the south, the Russians had just as much of a victory over the Austro-Hungarian armies down to the south. And that whole Pan-Slavic movement that led that tinderbox that we saw echoes of in the Balkans, is that movement as dead as it seems right now? Has it morphed into what I think it might be morphing as? Or is that Pan-Slavic attitude something that is still in the background that might creep up again?
That's a great question. I mean, you're quite right that it wasn't just those two empires. I mean, in a very real sense, World War One was the graveyard of empires. Of course, Germany did not survive in its current form, but especially as you pointed out, Russia was broken up. Turkey, the Ottoman Empire was broken up, and of course, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which had been sort of decentralizing over the course of the 19th century, ultimately fell as well, and just became Austria. What you're referring to when you talk about Pan-Slavism is certainly a movement. I mean, the 19th century was the age in which this national consciousness spread. And it wasn't just the Slavs. I mean, that's the age of the Young Turks. There was pretty much a young nationalist group of any ethnicity or religious group that you wanted to talk about. But yeah, the idea was that there would be a Slavic. Essentially, it started off essentially as a movement for a third. Part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Keep in mind, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, it was indeed Hungarians and Austrians within the same framework. So there was a big push on to have essentially a third kingdom within the empire, and that didn't pan out as we saw during the First World War. But as far as it's dead today, I mean that's sort of a, and I think that President Putin has been pretty good about appealing to that sort of sentiment, essentially positioning Russia as the protector of the Slavs, wherever the Slavs might be. Moscow, during the 19th century, always portrayed itself as the Third Rome. It was the heir to the Roman Empire and then to Constantinople, and then it was the Third Rome after those two Roman capitals. So I think that's, and I'm not a Russia specialist, but I think that there's at least something to that. Putin does seem to be able to reach out to that as well. We certainly don't hear about it the way we did back in the 1990s when Bosnia and Kosovo and all that stuff was going on, but I think it may still be in there in the background, and I guess we will see to what extent you can tap that. You also called attention to one other aspect. I think when you talked about those two empires, we tend to, back to the cultural thing, we tend from a cultural standpoint to sort of think that the Western Front was the entire fight in World War One. You mentioned Tannenberg. There was indeed a great war of movement, and the Germans did quite well on the Eastern Front. There was also maritime theaters in the Mediterranean, and particularly the operation at Gallipoli, and so on and so forth. So there really was a lot of stuff going on, and as well as the trench warfare that we're so familiar with from movies and books and so on and so forth.
You know, one of the ways you led into your article on five ways Germany could have won the first battle of the Atlantic is a discussion that Germany, as we know it now and as at the start of before World War One, was actually a remarkably new country, and some of what they were going through were simply growing pains. How much did that play into the way they tried to take up the mantle as a sea power? Is that can we kind of get into your article that way?
I mean it's just really if you think about British history and how long the British have been at this empire building business and how long they've been at this naval business. That's, I mean, Germany's only been a unified country since 1871. Before 1871, it was on the order of 39 little countries. And before Napoleon, who actually simplified the arrangement, it was on the order of 360 little tiny kingdoms and principalities. And that's really, to unify that country and then to build a great navy and make yourself into a colonial empire all in the space of around 30 years is a pretty big deal, or it's a pretty big effort to mount against a country that literally almost has seawater flowing through its veins. That's the metaphor that that Admiral Wegener, whose book I mentioned here and in other places, used to describe the British. He essentially said, look, you know, we're a new country. We don't understand the sea. In contrast to the British, who have been on the strategic offensive for many centuries, looking for opportunities to gain new geographic points across the globe to support trade and naval pursuits, he simply thought that the British had a cultural edge that the Germans really never quite caught on to, and that really made it a tough thing from a cultural standpoint for the Germans to catch up.
I think that's a great name. You actually stole part of my first question, but let's talk a little bit about Vice Admiral Wolfgang Wenninger. I don't know how you pronounce that in German. My German is worse than my English. His critique of what Imperial Germany did with its navy. That's one of the things that has now gone on my to-read list because I actually have quite a bit on the German Navy and World War One. I'll bring up why maybe later. But a lot of people have critiqued the decision made before the war of the Kaiser and Imperial Germany really, in a larger sense, investing so much capital, steel, the opportunity cost of creating this very modern and it proved itself, tactically at least, a very proficient naval fleet, that perhaps that wasn't the best investment in their resources. But I've always kind of looked at it differently, as it wasn't so much a poor investment and a bad opportunity cost, but they just never seemed to really understand what they could do with that fleet, building into that comment you made about the cultural, not understanding the sea. What are some of those things that, in hindsight at least, you can look at what they started the war with from a material point of view, that if they had the right intellectual thinking behind it, that they could have leveraged what they had and perhaps significantly impacted the course of the war?
Yeah, again, you packed a whole lot of material into one simple sounding question. Just for the readers who are not familiar with this book, it's really one of the, it's really one of the great works of sea power ever written, in my view. It was Wegener's book is titled the Naval Strategy of the World War. I believe it's out of print. It certainly was out of print when I got my copy, but the Naval Institute put it out in their Classics of Sea Power series back in the late 1980s, if I recall, mid 1989 or thereabouts. But Wegener's a fascinating character. He's kind of a maverick, like a lot of theorists are, like Sir Julian Corbett and to an extent Mahan. These are people who were not necessarily popular with the old guard, with the old naval guard, and certainly Wegener made no friends by critiquing Imperial German naval strategy the way he did. But he did. I mean, he said, look, we essentially made a cultural assumption about the Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy. They will come into the North Sea, and we will thrash them because the British Navy always seeks out a decisive engagement at the beginning of a naval war. They take that Trafalgar, the big battle in 1805, and they apply that to Britain's maritime strategy and just say, well, the British will come and fight us because the British always go and fight. Well, the British didn't really need to go into the North Sea other than just to safeguard Great Britain's shores against naval bombardment. So it was, and Wegener is deeply critical of that assumption, just because the British could cordon off the North Sea and block Germany's access to the Atlantic Ocean without even going in and having an engagement. And indeed, Wegener thought that was proper strategy. Corbett said much the same thing in his history of the First World War. So that's point two under that. There's another aspect of this that I would point to, and this probably goes back to your point about Germany being a maturing power, but not really an experienced sea power. I think there's a real tendency for these very energetic but inexperienced powers like Imperial Japan, Imperial Germany, and so forth, to really latch on to big ideas like Mahan's ideas about how to build a navy and what makes a nation a great sea power, and really just sort of and almost reduce those to tactics. Mahan himself said, "Look, the Germans are some of my favorites. You know, they are the people who have translated my books. The Kaiser says he's tried to memorize Mahan's influence of sea power upon history, which is almost unbelievable. Our students don't even like to read it, much less memorize it. The Japanese did lots of translations and tried to hire Mahan and so forth. These are powers that were really more Mahanian than Mahan." But they also seem to take Mahan and just sort of cherry-pick the stuff about battleships and decisive fleet engagements and reduce Mahan, who's a very big thinker, to tactics and to assume there's going to be a big naval battle for its own sake. Not necessarily the case. Even if you're the stronger naval power, you don't always necessarily risk your fleet if you don't need to. So I'm not sure that answered your question, but I think there's a lot of good grist in there.
Yeah, I think one of the my favorite quotes from your article was when you're talking about the lack, how you have to know your geography that you're dealing with, and the Germans didn't seem, despite the fact that they should have been fairly obvious. They didn't seem to grasp their geographic limitations. And the quote I like was the...
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it? Yeah, it's really, yeah. I mean, all you got to do is look at the map. If you can't get out through the English Channel and you can't get out between Britain and the Orkneys and Norway, what are you going to do?
Yeah, your quote was, facts of geography left Germany in command of water that meant little. I mean, I just thought that kind of captured the... I guess they learned in World War II. You do point out that they, for their submarines, they did make a push on getting the French and some of the other ports along the English Channel.
Absolutely. Yeah, in 1940, they outflanked. They did exactly what Wegener sees. Wegener was persona non grata, so they didn't give him credit, but they in effect, did what he said they should do geographically.
Yeah, Germany had islands in the Pacific, and one would think why weren't they more sea aware than? I mean, I know there've been historically, even in the short period of time they existed, a continental power, but how did they get away with being so unaware of the importance of sea?
I think it almost feels like they reverse engineered a rationale for building battleships, but just because battleships were cool. I mean, if you listen to what Admiral Tirpitz, sort of the Mahan, I guess he was sort of Germany's Mahan, although he wasn't a big thinker like Mahan or Corbett or one of these guys. But Tirpitz said, hey, you know, I don't worry about policy, I don't worry about grand strategy, I build ships. And a lot of what the Kaiser said, you know, it's very much in that spirit as well. I think it was Howard K. Beale, the great historian of Teddy Roosevelt's diplomacy, who pointed out that a big reason for the Navy building that we saw, not just in Germany and Japan, but also here in the United States, was just because navies were so much fun to have. It was just fun to steam around in those big dreadnoughts and so forth. So you get the sense that navies and navalists, people who back Navy building, have a real habit of falling in love with platforms and losing sight of the big things like the things that Wegener calls attention to in his book. He essentially reduces sea power. Mahan, of course, has his way of defining sea power. All the theorists do. Wegener has an interesting way of doing it that bears on this point. He says, well, sea power essentially is three things: a strategic factor, geography. A capable maritime state is going to be out looking for perhaps not colonies, but at least access to overseas ports. So it improves its geographic position. Secondly, he says obviously you need a fleet, merchant fleet, but especially a naval fleet. That's what he's thinking about, always building the Navy and thinking about how to overcome the strongest rival that you might get in a fight with. And thirdly, he almost sounds like Nietzsche, the great philosopher of man and Superman, where he talks about a nation's strategic will to the sea, which essentially I've always taken as meaning what we call strategic culture. Does the nation have a culture that is favorable to seaborne pursuits? Is it always on the lookout for the ability to improve its geographic position and build a stronger navy? So to me that's really one of the keys goes back to whether Germany is really a sea power in that sense. Does it have that drive to the sea? Does it need to go to sea in order to be a great industrial power? And so on and so forth. Interestingly, I think that the Chinese, who have studied this rather closely themselves, are also asking themselves a lot of these same questions. And that's one of the reasons this is a very useful historical case to look at, is just because it does shed some light on what we see going on in the world today.
Well, that's another perfect lead-in to the question that I wanted to ask you. You know, in Red Star Over the Pacific, you and Toshi spent a lot of time in effort, and I think it's great the translations that y'all have had come out with that. I think it's that the book has good legs, considering its kind of wonkish background. So congratulations to you and Toshi on that. And we've talked about Mahan, and to their credit, I think our Chinese counterparts are really making a good effort intellectually to look towards the past. They read Mahan arguably perhaps more than we do. And a lot of people, when they're trying to use a historical example of China, when maybe it's best just to say China is China, they do talk about Imperial Germany. What are those lessons that we believe that the Chinese have taken from a naval perspective, whether it's strategy, operational concepts, or, you know, shipbuilding priorities for a rising power that is building a navy, not really from scrap, but close to it from a modern context. What are those things that we think that China is looking at Imperial Germany as to put into the mix for their decision-making process?
Yeah, I think there are probably two things to call attention to. One, I think the key, it's not so much the Navy that the Chinese draw inspiration from when they look at the German example, although I think that they certainly ask themselves a lot of the same questions. Toshi and I have we've done a number of articles over the years, and I did a couple even before that myself, essentially drawing this comparison, looking at the geography. We actually think that it would be wrong to poo-poo China just because it is a continental power ringed by island chains and so on and so forth. If you were to compare the maps of those two countries, you'll see that China has a lot more access to the sea than Germany ever did. I would certainly not define the South China Sea or the East China Sea as dead seas the way Wegener called the North Sea, for example. So there's some of that stuff going on as well. I think that probably the bigger point that the Chinese are thinking about with regard to this is more of a diplomatic and a political point. They say, well, in a very short space of time, Germany essentially provided two different models for a rising power. And in fact, they did a book and a TV series a few years ago looking at this and trying to avoid all the bad things that befell the Germans and take inspiration from the good things that they did. Now, the two models would be essentially Otto von Bismarck's Germany, which would be up to about 1990 when the Kaiser fired him, and then the Kaiser's Germany, of course, after that, which was the one that marched Europe into World War I. The key points that the Chinese will take out of these cases are these. For Bismarck, after he waged a series of very small and limited wars against Denmark, against Austria, and then against France, was able to forge a united Germany. But at that point, he went out of his way to persuade all European states that this big new power in their midst was not going to essentially attack them and steal their territory and do all of these other things. He tried to persuade European powers, France, Britain, and so on and so forth, that the Germany was a satisfied power. It had no more designs on their territory and thus wouldn't march Europe into a general war. That model of self-restraint is the one that the Chinese would like to emulate as they do what they think is worth doing around their periphery. And, of course, the bad example, of course, is the Kaiser's Germany. The Kaiser is very erratic. You couldn't really predict what he was going to do. Well, we know as military people that you can either plan against capabilities or you can plan against intentions. If you have no idea whatsoever what the intentions are, what are you going to do? Well, if the unpredictable power starts building a great navy, you're going to try to match them ship for ship because you don't know what they're going to do with it. And that's kind of a dangerous thing, setting up a cycle of interaction across the North Sea between the British and the Germans. And that's what the Chinese would like to avoid with us in particular, we being the resident power in the Western Pacific. So I guess to boil all that down to a bumper sticker, I guess the takeaway is to be Bismarckian Germany and don't be the Kaiser's Germany.
you point out one of the other ways that Germany could have been more successful in their maritime efforts in World War I. And what I wrote down was go asymmetric early. Are the Chinese, would you kind of talk about that, and are the Chinese looking down that path too today?
I think that's, and I again, I don't know that I would necessarily connect this directly to their reading of Germany. I mean, these are people with minds of their own. They don't just try to slavishly follow up past examples. But I certainly don't think they would find anything in the German case to disabuse them of what they have done. I would say that the PLA Navy and the supporting arms of sea power, you know, aircraft and so forth operating from shore, this was very much an asymmetric force until the Chinese were pretty confident about their anti-access capabilities, and now they're starting to do things that look more symmetric, you know, building DDGs and building aircraft carriers and so on and so forth. So I think that if indeed they do read German history and take inspiration, they probably find that as something that ratifies their approach. The PLA Navy has been kind of an interesting beast just because it did do the asymmetric thing first. But even as it starts doing the, I mean, it went back to the tradition of Mao, you know, Mao and People's War at Sea and so forth, all of these small platforms that make things tough on a big navy around China's periphery. They've stayed true to that tradition, you know, with their Hobie catamarans and all their different shore-based missiles and so forth, even as they start doing blue water things. So we see kind of an interesting hybrid fleet coming into being that's quite unlike our own, which, of course, is a big ship fleet.
I wanted to roll something by you here. When we look at a pre-war mentality and view and behavior, is, you know, we were talking about China, Imperial Germany, how does that react? But when you look at what happened again recently, we had the Chinese intercepting one of our maritime patrol aircraft, this time one of our new P-8s as opposed to one of our old EP-3s like they did back in 2001. When you look at a mentality, one thing that has characterized some parts of the Chinese military attitude, and I think in his book, Duty, former Secretary of Defense Gates, kind of touches on this as well, is there's a certain flintiness, a certain bravado, thumping of the chest due to insecurity that in some ways reminds me of, not Imperial Germany before the First World War, but Imperial Russia. And part of that easy to be offended, what looks strong on paper may not be what can actually hit the field, strength in numbers but weak in quality and modernity. Are there some things about the mentality that helped lead to the First World War that involved the cultural and the attitude of Imperial Russia that might be a little close to the psyche that we see in present-day China?
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison. I've never really taken it on in any detail, but I think there's probably something there. And again, you talk about bravado and flintiness and sort of a real insecurity on the part of the Chinese. I always, if I don't know what to say about a question, I usually fall back on Thucydides. I would go back to Thucydides' ideas of fear, honor, and interest. The Chinese clearly are very cognizant of the fact that the PRC, the People's Republic of China, has existed for since 1949, and they really would like China to essentially put to rest the century of humiliation dating from the Opium Wars of the 1840s and forward. They would like to put that all behind them by the centennial of the founding of the PRC. So I think that's a real driver in a lot of the things that they're doing around their periphery. So you can see that they fear American dominance of their backyard. They have an honor motive in putting that century of humiliation again at the hands of Western sea powers behind them. And then obviously they have material interests, just as we all do in the maritime realm: resources, control of territory, all the things that nations tend to do. So yeah, and I think you could bind that back to Russia. Henry Kissinger famously described the Russian Empire as defining its success as an empire by how much acreage it added to the empire every year. And so I don't see China as being a conquering power in that sense, but you do see that sort of restlessness and that sort of honor motive at play in China today. It is when dealing with the Chinese can be rather difficult once you flip on certain topics, maritime claims in the South China Sea or whatever they might be, and you can see all these kind of things at work. Yeah. I might point out that the Russians got their rear ends handed to them by the Japanese in 1904 and 1905. So perhaps that's a caution for the Chinese as they look out into the world today.
Well, in the pre-show, I kind of talked about the impression I got of World War I, since we're talking about it 100 years ago, that if there, I characterize it as a war that started all wars. I mean, we've, since World War One, let's talk about what the impact has been by the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, what that's done to the Middle East. Talk about what, you know, we've got the Balkan situation, which also arose ultimately out of World War One. We've got all kinds of situations, the breakup of the empires, which affected Africa. How much can we look back at World War One and say it really was the start of a much bigger story than just a four-year or five-year period of war.
Yeah, it is interesting to look ahead, to gaze ahead and try to figure out how people will classify this this long 20th century. Are we in the middle of, I mean, obviously the British and the French didn't think they were fighting the Hundred Years' War back when they were fighting the Hundred Years' War. That was a title that was put on that long period of intermittent struggle by historians much later. It'd be interesting to know what this era will be called by our children and grandchildren. As far as the legacy of World War One, I mean, one thing we learned very clearly in the 1990s was simply the fact that borders don't always allow a particular ethnic group, a particular group that defines it as a nation or a religious group or whatever. Those boundaries don't always conform to political boundaries on the map, and that there's a lot of different cross-border claims. These lead to different political controversies, raised passions, and all that sort of thing. There was I think it was Joseph Chamberlain, the colonial secretary of Great Britain, during the Versailles Conference after the war. I may have my speaker wrong, but it was one of the protagonists at Versailles called it a group of all powerful, all ignorant men drawing lines on maps, essentially redrawing the map of the world to try to divide up the Ottoman Empire and essentially apportion it out to the European powers. And a lot of times, and people like Gertrude Bell, who are Middle East specialists from after the war, they simply observed that these borders a lot of times did not make sense. The related thing from the British standpoint, of course, the United States didn't gain territory out of World War One, but the imperial powers, Britain and France, did. And these powers were exhausted powers. Britain essentially took on another million square miles of empire, even in 1918 and following, when it had very few resources. It demobilized its army, essentially took away the means to enforce such a big new swath of empire. That left Britain during the wars, between the wars, essentially trying to do things like police from the air, sort of a precursor to our drone strikes that we know today, essentially try to cow Middle Eastern populations into submission from the air when they defied Britain's will. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on there between exhausted powers trying to police big new empires, and also with simply having divided, simply drawn borders where they didn't necessarily make any sense. Something that interestingly, the ISIL, whatever you want to call it, the Islamic State over there, made a big deal about essentially negating the border between Iraq and Syria because that overthrew the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which essentially set that boundary way back when in the World War One era. So that's something that's very much living even in the region today.
Yeah, I don't think that is going to go anywhere anytime soon either. You mentioned something earlier on in the show that I think, you know, people who do, much to my family's chagrin when they're trying to get from point A to point B, I'm a notorious monument reader. If I come across a monument, I have to stop and look at it.
Got to do it.
I get fussed out on a regular basis. And you're right, when you're over in the UK, you see a memorial, and more often than not, it's about the Great War, the First World War, not the Second World War. And there's also a small Belgian town that used to be about a 45-minute drive from where I used to live that has a really neat monument that originally I thought was religious because it's a gilded statue of Jesus, but it was actually the small village that was liberated twice by Americans, and it had a Belgian flag and American flag on either side of the statue of Jesus, liberated by Americans during both world wars. And just about an hour drive from there into France, there was another small town that had a memorial that had the people from the village in the local area who had died in conflict. World War One, you basically have one side of the obelisk and half of another. Second World War, you have a half dozen names. And the impact of the First World War on the belligerent nations when we come up to the Second World War is something that I've never thought has really – I'll give you one example. Admiral Stavridis a few years ago, I saw he has a TEDx-type speech that he gave back when he was SACEUR, and he puts up there a picture of the French Military Academy class of 1914. Everybody in that picture was killed in the Great War.
Wow.
And he talks about how that experience for the French in the First World War impacted their psyche and their ability to react to German aggression 20 years later. Well, other nations had just as big of an impact, some more per capita basis than the French had, and obviously that manifested itself differently in other places. And I always thought that excuse that is commonly used prevents people from really looking closely at the beginning of the Second World War, that when you looked at it on paper, there's no reason the French army should have collapsed as fast as it was. There had to be, and there's been some good writing on it, some political military level mistakes, missteps, and inefficiencies on the French side that perhaps are more important for people to think about and discuss than just to excuse the French performance based upon what happened in the First World War. Question to you after another too long question. You know, what is your thought about that common case saying that the French just couldn't make it happen because they're experiencing the First World War? And how did that experience of the Great War impact the major belligerents differently?
Well, with regard to the French, I certainly would not. I wouldn't be one of those who would trace their collapse in 1940 back to the First World War. It does feel like, I mean, if you read about France during the wars, it does feel like they were really in a defensive crouch after the First World War. If you think about, when we look at the end, any war termination settlement, but I think it's particularly acute with the Versailles settlement. You always ask yourself, if I want to craft a durable peace, I need to ask myself, how much do I need to do militarily? How far do I need to go? What do I demand at the peace table? Am I demanding too much, which is possible, because you can obviously create a power that's going to come back and try to turn the tables on you later. So am I demanding the right amount politically that I've won on the battlefield? And finally, and this, of course, is the key question, is who's going to enforce the peace? If you look at what happened with France, the French quite clearly felt themselves to be abandoned by their British and American allies after the First World War. That left them looking for allies in places like Czechoslovakia, basically these small powers on either side of Germany that weren't going to do much, weren't going to do much good to them in a future conflict. And I think it almost seemed like this really almost deflated the French psyche. But again, I think you're right not to overplay that too much. The Germans, the German military during the Second World War, they really were quite innovative, in part because of the harsh provisions imposed upon the army and the air force and so forth by the Versailles settlement. They couldn't keep large forces in being, so they fought. They kept a small corps. They thought about what to do, and this is where you see the concepts like Blitzkrieg, this innovative use of armor and infantry and air power together to punch holes in an enemy's force. And that's something that really paid off for the Germans in 1940. It's kind of interesting, after they fought the short war with Poland and did what they needed to do in Poland in 1939, they actually took a few. This inaugurated the period of what was called the Phony War, when essentially the British and the French came into the war into 1940, but there wasn't any fighting. The Germans, while that was happening, were essentially looking at lessons learned from the war with Poland and updating their practices and doctrine and strategy and so forth. So you have to give the Germans credit for rolling up the French. They actually did some things rather well. I'm not sure how the French could have kept pace. There's an interesting book that we read with our junior course students about military innovation during the interwar period. It's written by Williamson Murray, our former colleague here at the War College. But they actually look at a lot of hardware stuff that goes along with this in the different countries. And I think the key takeaway from their book is that little choices on hardware and doctrine can have huge effects down the road. For example, the British, even though they pioneered naval aviation, they ended up falling behind and not being nearly as capable as the Japanese and the United States. So there's little ripple effects that will come back to bite you potentially in the future from choices that you make today. So kind of a ramble, but I certainly wouldn't fault the French for just folding up like a cheap suit in 1940.
One of the other great stories of World War One that probably deserves more attention than we give it today had to do with code breaking and things like the Zimmerman telegram, which you know, we're talking about long-term effects. The Germans tried to sway the Mexicans into attacking the U.S. and reclaiming big chunks of the Southwest United States. Are there ramifications of that linger on today, or had an impact in the years following World War One?
With the Zimmer, I don't think it lingers on so much here in the United States as far to the south. I mean, our Latin American friends remember all this stuff forever. We hear, for example, about the Monroe Doctrine and things like that from our Latin American students to this day. The United States, or Americans, as you know, we're very historically forgetful. Which I guess is good in a sense, because we don't hold grudges the way other peoples do a lot of times. But at the same time, we also don't learn what we probably should from history. Now, with regard to the Zimmerman, I mean, it's another one of those things what's happening in the United States during that period between the outbreak of World War One and the time the United States goes into France starting in April of 1917. And some of that stuff, like you said, it has to do with Mexico. The United States intervenes in Mexico under President Wilson a couple of times. Wilson is extremely high-handed towards our Latin American neighbors. So for example, he justifies occupying Veracruz by the United States essentially going in and teaching the Mexicans to elect good men. That's very close to an exact quotation from Wilson. So this is not the kind of thing that's going to set very well with your neighbors, especially given the United States' history of intervening around its periphery from the mid-1890s or so forth. So there's some bad feelings to the south. But on the United States, I mean, there are some recent things that have happened within the last few decades that would still have struck a chord with Americans in those days. For example, think about during our Civil War. We pay a lot of attention to Lee and Grant and all those big events that are happening in the United States. But at the same time, France took the opportunity to essentially, you mentioned Mexico, to essentially invade Mexico and put, of all things, an Austrian the Emperor Maximilian, on the throne of Mexico, thus defying the Monroe Doctrine, thus establishing a position in the Western Hemisphere that was directly threatening to the United States, especially if the Civil War ended up with a rift between the Confederacy and the United States over the long haul. And so on and so forth. Spain came into the Western Hemisphere and did some things in the Caribbean and South America. I think these are some of the cultural reasons that the Zimmerman telegram really created a lot of controversy, because it looked like Europeans coming into our backyard and flouting what we saw as our prerogatives in our own backyard. And that's something that's really going to resonate.
You know, I wouldn't limit this to the major combatants of the First World War, but we always like to talk about, you know, you don't want to prepare to fight the last war, but you want to, you know, take what you can learn from actual recent operational experience and decide what you need for a future fleet. And just looking at it from a naval point of view, by the time the Second World War comes around, which nations seem to inculcate the lessons of the First World War and the interwar technical developments best? And which nations just didn't really get it or weren't paying attention to what happened in the First World War and missed an opportunity to perhaps invest their money better in the fleet that showed up for the second?
Oh, wow. Well, that leaves us with a lot of contenders to talk about. Well, I mean, obviously the Germans did pretty well, except that Hitler forced them into war long before, especially the German Navy, thought that it was going to be ready. The German naval commanders thought that they weren't going to go to war until 1945 or 1946, when a lot of the big things that we saw building at the beginning of the war would have been ready and would have equipped Germany to make a good fight vis-a-vis the Royal Navy in particular. So, in a sense, Germany did pretty well down on the operational and hardware and tactical levels, but obviously it was very poorly led from a political standpoint and got into a fight before it was really ready to take that and run with it. I think the Japanese actually did. And I guess we could expand this out. The Japanese technically were a combatant in World War One and ended up at Versailles for part of the peace settlement. The Japanese did pretty well in a lot of ways, and particularly with naval aviation. Ultimately, Yamamoto was able to put aviation at the center of the Pearl Harbor strike and Japanese strategy. But they also did rather poorly in a lot of ways, particularly with submarine warfare. They built capable fleet boats, but then they simply did not use them against the U.S. Navy as it moved men and material across the Pacific. Just a total mystery why they didn't attack transports and so forth and make things really hard on the United States, force the U.S. to divert assets from the Atlantic into the Pacific, and do all these things that you could do with that capable undersea fleet. So I think Japan was kind of a mixed bag. Great Britain again. I think they chose to put a lot of their eggs in the fighter, the Royal Air Force and so forth, and use land-based implements of sea power. Obviously, that worked out pretty well with them because you mentioned they did code breaking well, they did radar well. This ended up working out pretty well for the British. As far as who did best, I guess that would be kind of a big question to answer. The United States was sort of a mixed bag. We had a great undersea fleet, but we had crappy torpedoes. I mean, there's just a lot of little threads to pull there.
One of the issues that Britain faced, I'm not sure if Germany had the same problem, was the loss of a lot of. And I'm going to credit Matt Hipple for this question. A lot of its best and brightest in the trenches and battlefields of France during the war. How much did that have an impact on the Brits and the French and whoever and the Germans in World War II? Did the right people learn the lessons of World War I, or were the Brits drained very much so much that they had trouble in World War II?
Yeah, I mean that's another great question from Matt. That's really a big question. I think it certainly felt like the French were, as we discussed a few minutes ago, where the French really felt like they were sort of culturally drained. The British, I think, just because they did keep trying to police that empire, and they made out okay. They muddled through with the empire, the expanded empire that came out of. World War One with. It does feel as though the British were not. I mean, there was obviously a lot of cultural stuff going on in Great Britain. If you look at the literature and the art and all that stuff in Great Britain from the interwar years, a lot of it is very bleak. There was a great book a few years ago by a historian by the name of Richard O'Very, who wrote the huge book How the Allies Won. But he also did a book about why Great Britain, even though it didn't suffer nearly as much in World War One as France, for example, or Germany, why it was so culturally pessimistic during the war. That was the era in which George Orwell was doing his works, Aldous Huxley was doing his works, and all of these things. So British society, I think, had a really visceral response to the conflict, but it didn't. My impression is that it didn't really translate into the armed forces, which by all accounts were extremely professional and very motivated and all the things that you like to see in a military force. So I think the British made out reasonably well. French not so well. The United States, as we know, withdrew into itself, except for commerce and things. And tried to forget about World War One. So, and indeed, I think we overreacted. We probably overreacted, but we had all the devil theories of war and all that stuff floating around after World War One. I'm not sure you could come up with a ranking of these things too well, but certainly different powers did. And of course, the Germans took inspiration out of World War One with Hitler's stab in the back theories and all of these things that were in vogue during the war and actually helped Hitler come to power in the 1930s. So I guess in a sense the Germans drew sustenance out of that experience from a political standpoint, from a passion standpoint, as much as from war fighting methods and so forth.
Well, as usual, I have another hour's worth of questions, but I'm not going to impose on you for another hour.
I don't know if I have another hour's worth of answers, but we
No, I was even both of another reason I kind of like the World War One topic, and I've enjoyed reading a lot of things online, is both of my grandfathers were battleship sailors in the First World War, which was
awesome.
Talk about deployed tonnage that did a bunch of nothing, but it was a good experience.
The Navy has a fascinating experience in that time with the Asiatic Fleet. My current project is a history of the U.S. Asiatic Fleet. There's a lot of stuff going on in that period, especially leading up to the First World War, but really from Commodore Perry's voyage to Japan in the 1850s, really all the way up to 1942 when the fleet is sunk. It's really quite interesting.
The speaking of interesting, we mentioned one book, Wolfgang's the Naval Strategy of the World of the World War. Are there some other books out there for people that are interested in doing more than what I've done this summer, which is reread The Guns of August about the First World War, that may be in the background that would really be worth their time to read? And as a follow-on question, you also have another book kind of in the works. I didn't know whether you wanted to show a little bit of leg here, but if talk about what you have coming up as well.
As far as what I've got coming up, I'm working on the Asiatic Fleet, kind of as a model as what, a model for what the United States or any navy that has a small fleet out in somebody else's backyard ought to do. Japan being the dominant regional power in those days, and obviously China becoming a serious player in the Western Pacific today. So I'm having a look at that. There actually hasn't ever been a history strictly of the Asiatic Fleet. So it's kind of trying to break a little new ground here. Toshi and I have just concluded a contract to do essentially a Red Star of the Pacific version for applied to Japan. So we'll have a look at Japanese sea power from a grand standpoint. As far as the book recommendations, I think we only have a minute or so. The one book that I thoroughly enjoyed, it's a real doorstop, but Robert Massey's book Dreadnought, which is about the coming of the Great War and the Great Naval Arms Race, is fantastic. It's kind of neat because it has a lot of capsule biographies of all the different players, Jackie Fisher, obviously Jellicoe, you know, all these different big De Keyser, all these big players in these events. You can really get a pretty good intro into World War One within one cover, and also get a good dose of naval stuff. The other books would be Paul Kennedy's works, familiar from Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, but also did a fantastic book called The Rise of the Anglo-German Antagonism, and also a history of the naval competition. So I guess those would be the two authors I would check out if you're eager to get a window into this stuff.
Well, excellent. Well, again, really appreciate you taking time to come for a return visit to Midrats. It's been a real enjoyable hour, and I encourage everybody, before the month of August is over, if you haven't done already, do a little bit of reading and thinking about the First World War. And look forward to reading the stuff you have coming down the road, Jim, and hope you have a good year coming up this fall.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Jim.
You bet. Talk soon.
And thank you very much for joining us here on Midrats. We'll be having a best of next weekend. But until we see you back, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.